This is continuing with Jennison on 31st August 76. And so you were saying that even today...
Yes, even at this conference, they are still arguing and still don't know the answers to what causes the two blobs to either side of Cygnus or any of its now thousands of counterparts in the sky. We don't know the answer. So I don't think you can blame us way back in the early 50s thinking the cladding gases was a good argument to say. And somehow I did, yes, I did spend quite a bit of time in those days trying to think what was going on. And I think even in my thesis, there's a lot of dabble of one or two ideas of what might be causing it. I was rather favouring plasma oscillation type signals in those days. Synchrotron was just coming on the scene, I think. I can't quite remember when this really came up. But I was trying to think out plasma solutions as to how you could get the radiation in those parts, because we thought that the sun was probably plasmaing a bit. And one came up with some jolly good ideas, but they don't seem to be the right ones. And I didn't publish them.
But the ultimate energy source, what were you thinking there?
I think then we probably did think that the galaxies were colliding. The point is, Barnum and Minkowski, two very, very great astronomers, were so adamant then, and they really were adamant, that these were colliding galaxies. I think I quoted myself in a book, a paragraph of Minkowski's, quite a bit later, 56, something like that. No, it was the Paris Conference, that's right, the same conference. Paris Symposium, where Minkowski was absolutely adamant about it being colliding galaxies and how it was proved that these were colliding and so on.
The two line systems and so forth.
So, all right, we had to defer to the experts. These chaps knew what they were doing.
Were you thinking at that time of these things expanding away from the galaxy somehow as a result of the collision?
I think I probably did. Yes. It had to be, really. In fact, we even thought of lifetime as a result of that. We tried to think what this implied.
Right.
Certainly we did. There seemed to be no other way out.
Any notion of looking for proper motions or anything like that?
Not that I recall.
Yeah. Well, I think that can probably be ruled out with a good calculation.
We were just intrigued. I remember talking to Professor Blackett at that time. I remember at the time his early measurements, Blackett was still at Manchester, and he was senior to Lovell there it is, and mentioned to him the different measurements from Cassiopeia and Cygnus, and the fact that one seemed to be, possibly this time, just about the time that the observation had been made optically and so on as well. Of course it would have been, it's just after. And Blackett said something I've never forgotten, because there were arguments that the Cygnus source and the Cassiopeia source could have entirely different origins or raisons d'etre or whatever you like. And Blackett said, and I think it was Lovell, or maybe Lovell and Hanbury Brown, but comes reeling off all sorts of things this way. And Blackett said something that sort of stopped me in my tracks. He said, "No, chaps, you can't have that. Too many criminals." Now, I've remembered that all my scientific life, okay? And so often, when members of my staff and others and so on get involved in certain work, and there seems to be a difference between certain things with a strong common denominator, I use the same expression now myself. Careful, chaps. Mind you don't get too many criminals. In other words, I would say still that there are strong common denominators between Cassiopeia and Cygnus.
Right.
They're not the same all over. But if you like, well, probably synchrotron radiation or something like that, right? Yeah. There was a common denominator.
Yeah.
And I shall never forget those words of Blackett. There was a very experienced experimentalist coming out and saying it sticks with you for the rest of your life. Don't get too many criminals.
Maybe I'm a bit dense, but is the meaning there that usually only takes one criminal to commit a crime.
That's right. Why bother to have two criminals if one could do it?
Right. Okay. Now, when did you actually finally get your degree?
My first degree in 1950, my PhD degree in 54.
And I see that Jennison and Dasgupta, 56, in Phil Mag.
Very much later.
Is where you write up in detail your results.
Yes. Incidentally, Dasgupta got his degree a year earlier. I didn't entirely please Ratcliffe, who was my external examiner with my first version. What I'd done was to, thinking that Dasgupta and I would get the same external examiner, Dasgupta had written up all the experimental results, so I avoided the experimental results and wrote up about technique entirely. And the first account of the three season problem, things like that, and a lot of other interferometers that have since come on the markets, and the single disc multiplying grating, things like that.
Yes.
You'll find in my thesis, because I got intrigued with the techniques.
I see.
Okay.
And, but I had to put another chapter in to please Radcliffe, so as a year later, actually, after this, I kept thinking about actual PhD.
I see.
But that's by the way. You were saying something else. I've had a paper in 56.
Well, I was just saying that this was the write-up of...
Yes, it was, and it was very late, because Gus got to about then, I think, left, go back to India.
But these techniques you're talking about, that's never published anywhere else other than your thesis?
Through my thesis, that's all. Yeah. And the odd ones, I think the little book I did on Read Astronomy, some of them are missing, not all of them, because in those days, one went right round the houses, if one was interested, in such things as thinking up new types of interferometer.
Yeah.
And the facelift of interferometer, I thought of necessity, because the measurements we're just discussing on Cygnus, for example, first of all, were made with an intensive interferometer, which was not very sensitive to low visibilities. And so one wanted to use a Michelson interferometer. But how the heck do you use a Michelson interferometer on those sort of baselines in those days at those frequencies? You know, going 10 miles or 50 or 20 miles, I think, in the end of the ultimate thing. How could you do that in the circumstances when you could not have a surveyed rail track, you could not put cables over all the, in between the legs of the cows,
right,
and all that? You had to do something different. And so somehow or other thought up how to get around that problem, and came out with a solution that if one had three apertures, multiplied the three apertures together, so you've got three different print systems coming out, then by something which even today I can hardly credit, actually, I think it's quite remarkable, that three-station interferometer, if you put an error into any one of the channels, it disappears. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable. You put in a wedge of ionosphere, you put an extra bit of cable, you change the height of one of the aerials, you can do almost anything to it, and you still get the right answer, which is an extraordinary fact, and I still surprise myself about it. It doesn't seem possible sometimes that it gets rid of so much.
Yeah.
In fact, very much later than that, I don't know how much later, I mean, the late 50s, possibly early 60s, late 50s. I remember Martin Ryle saying we'd never be able to measure the visibility function on very long baselines, because in particular of the ionosphere being different over the stations.
Yeah.
And I remember getting up and saying, you're not quite right, Martin. The three-station thing will do it. And you wouldn't believe it. But it is true. You can actually use that principle on with a very different ionosphere over the different sites.
Well, I think it has been used in VLBI since.
I think it may well have been. Yeah. It has certainly been used in optics. Now an infrared and optic technique, which is rather pleasing. It's found some home.
Why did you publish, this in Phil Mag? That's where Hanbury, Brown and Twiss published.
You know why? You see, being a very impressible research student, one was impressed the most of all in those days by the papers by that great man Michelson, which were published in the Philosophical Magazine of 1880 or whatever it was, 1890, right? So one thought the place to publish that is the Philosophical Magazine, not realizing that nobody ever read the Philosophical Magazine.
You were thinking about future generations more than present readers.
Yes, the obvious place to put it was where Magnuson put his.
Is that what influenced Hanbury Brown also?
It might well have been. I can't speak for Hanbury, but certainly there's a reason that I did it.
Okay, well, what was the next step?
Where were we?
Like you say, you saw that the intensity interferometer had limited applications.
Right. So I thought up the three-station interferometer, which had the advantage that it was phase sensitive, and as well as being a Michelson interferometer, and was therefore much more sensitive than the intensity interferometer, it was also phase sensitive. So that one could then, in principle, measure everything one wanted to about the source. What one could not do with a three-station principle was to measure the absolute position of the source. What you get with that system is a reconstruction of any part of the sky without an absolute datum of reference. But the part of the sky it reconstructs is in itself intact.
Right.
It's just that you can't place it as being in any particular direction, unless you have an identifying object included in that reconstruction, which does give you a fix. Then it's easy. So then I took on a research student called Latham, Dasgupta left, back to India. This lad called Latham I got to help to build up a new interferometer. This was also a radio link interferometer, using three apertures. We tried it out first of all on the campus at Jodrell Bank, just between the diesel engine house and my own lab, a distance of about 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
It worked beautifully. And then we applied that to the measurements of Cygnus, confirmed indeed that Cygnus was a doublet.
Yeah.
And measured very accurately this time. And this does not appear in the published papers so much as it does in the actual records we have, our own personal records. Measured very accurately the depth of the first minimum. In fact, we sat an aerial actually within yards, definitely, of that. We moved the aerial literally only a matter of yards and found out exactly where that came.
I see.
And we found it remarkable accuracy. With that particular system, you only need to use a dipole for that. I think you use a dipole and reflector, just move it around. The two other aerials being bigger.
Yeah.
But we found out very precisely where that came. And we did the first phase-sensitive measurements, I suppose, of any radio source. And therefore the first synthesis, if you like, unambiguous synthesis up to the value of the points we got of any source.
In a sense, that's right. Yeah.
It is true, I suppose. It was the first synthesis, basically. Using the word in a different sense to Martin Ryle's wonderful synthesis, where he actually does a real... He takes the results pouring out from his interferometer and then synthesizes back to get this guy. What we did a synthesis, but by the approach of model fitting to get the same result, but it was a synthesis.
You didn't actually do a Fourier transform.
It's a mixture. It's very difficult to describe it. It's a matter of feel. You do a model fit, you change it a bit, you transform back, and
it's
an interplay between the two.
What's the word? Trial and error,
It's more of a trial and error.
Until it's consistent with the data.
That's right.
And then you stop there.
That's right. Yes, so, yes.
But you can't always be sure that you might have found some minimum, that there might be several things that are consistent with the data, and you've just honed in on one.
That's right. This is where we come back to an earlier point, really, about faith in some peculiar thing, the je ne sais quoi, I don't know what it is.
Right.
Yes, the only point I'd made, though, I think, is that this was the first time that, I mean, as the... with the intensity-rometer, we'd done the very first structure on the source. With the phase-sensitive interferometer, we did the first, phase-sensitive structure, if you like, the first unambiguous within the number of points.
You didn't have to assume symmetry,
Yes, we made sure that the objects were symmetrical. In fact, it was with that interferometer that we discovered something asymmetrical about Cassiopeia.
Yes, tell me.
Okay, I'll tell you. The Cassiopeia source, at a fairly low level on our interferometer, showed one or two things. It showed, first of all, that it was limb-brightened above a uniformly distributed disk. Fairly markedly so, initially, and certainly quite sufficiently so for us to publish the fact that it did. We just dismissed it in one sentence. We said that we observed that the distribution is more limb-brightened than that of a uniformly related disk. But it was fairly clear-cut. And also we observed that there was apparently a spur to one side.
I see.
Now, when we first got that, we got onto Minkowski. In fact, I've got a vague feeling that we gave some very early slides, to Hambury Brown, who took them to a conference in America, maybe the American University or something, I can't remember what it was. And he showed them there, and Minkowski got onto it. Minkowski went onto the Mount Palomar dish, telescope, and looked carefully at the side of Cassiopeia and found, indeed, a spur on the side of Cassiopeia, on the side of his head. And he got this faint detail for extension going right out. And, Minkowski's written up all about that. He saw something of that. Now, the fascinating thing about this was that we put Minkowski onto this one. We published it a bit belatedly. I mentioned already the delays in those days in publishing stuff. Not all sort of anything there. But we ultimately did publish it. We'd made our measurements at a fairly low frequency, around about 130 megacycles. When we'd made them a long time ago, 54, whatever it was, 55. And Cassiopeia certainly seemed to show something going out that way. Now, all I can really say there for the moment is that I believe in those early measurements. There was something to the side of Cassiopeia, I'm certain. And it's rather fascinating the way that, for example, Minkowski actually found something there.
So. Yeah.
All subsequent work, or to all sorts of work, my knowledge, until very, very recently, has tended to be at very high frequencies. And indeed, the limb brightening Cassiopeia shone out beautifully in things like the epsosynthesis of the various laboratory since then, particularly Martin Ralph's work. The extraordinary thing in the first of, one noticed in the first of the beautiful pictures from Martin Rowell's synthesis was that where I said there was a spur, he had a gap in his ring. I just see. The same position, there was a gap. And but this was a synthesis at 1400 megacycles or something.
Right. This is now in the mid-60s sometime.
Yes, sometime then, yes. And all the later ones have shown more and more detailed structure and, well, reinforced his own ideas. But I was always sure that there was this spur sticking out to one side. So it meant one of two things, which I think we probably mentioned in the first paper, either that it, maybe it's since then, that the spur was temporally variable, or spectrally variable relative to the rest of the cassiopeia. Right. It was a different spectrum. And only in the last 2 years, or year, 2 years I suppose it is, two American observations have started to point to this again when I quoted this early paper. One, forgive me, I've forgotten the authors.
Clark Lake, was it in? You mean low frequencies?
One was a VLB observation at 111 megacycles or 75 megacycles, in which they found the something to the side of Cassiopeia, getting much more pronounced at 75 than it was at 111. But this sounds a bit like a point of some sort, but stuck off to one side, but with a different spectrum to Cassiopeia. And they gave various, there were many ambiguities in the VLB, they gave various possible positions, but they rather favoured one which coincided with my spur interested. The other observation was the very recent one. Who was it? It's been checked out at Cambridge in the last few months, that the spectrum of Cassiopeia at 35 megacycles is very much enhanced compared to that at
the integrated spectrum.
Which could well be due to the spectrum. So it may or may not. But at the moment, the only bit of radio astronomy I'm personally doing at the moment is actually going back and using the old three-station interferometer at 35 megacycles to look again at Cassiopeia and seeing if there is a distribution out that way on.
I see.
It needn't be a spur, it can be a point source. Now, talking of ambiguities in readings, and looking at that paper by Jennison and Latham in the mid-50s, whatever it was, the spur is one solution. A point source to one side could give the same first-order distribution. It's either.
Well, let me ask you about some meetings at this time. You probably were at both the 1953 and 55 Jodrell Bank Symposium.
Yes.
Do you have any recollections of either of those meetings? What you might have learned from them, or what the atmosphere was?
The atmosphere was wonderful. You had a lot of people starting off a new science, and certainly as a new boy oneself, one benefited very much indeed from those early symposia. Now, what did we learn? I think probably the same as tends to be so even today. Such things as this Grenoble meeting, one learnt much more by meeting and talking to other people over a cup of coffee or a glass of beer than one learnt necessarily from the formal presentations. I can't really tell you more than that, but I always remember them.
You think? It seems to me this might have been a part of the problem between the antagonism between Sydney and Cambridge, is that they had so few opportunities to discuss things over a glass of beer. Would you agree with that?
Well, at those meetings, one certainly got from contact between the Cambridge people and the Sydney people and the Manchester people, but I think you're left with this fact that Cambridge have always been secretive. They still are. This is rather curious. In fact, I've got three radio astronomers on my staff at the moment, ex-Martin Rowell chaps, and within my own laboratory you can recognise quite clearly this group of three.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
are apart, if you like, and they are a little group within themselves, and that it's carried forward. It's a heritage of Cambridge.
Were you implying that that this was more the cause of the troubles than the great distance between Australia and England?
I think it might be. Cambridge were never terribly anxious to discuss with others and to get help from others on anything. They wanted to do it themselves and keep it themselves. Perhaps I shouldn't have said that. No, I think I can, because I think it's probably acknowledged by everybody that Cambridge have always sat on things and sorted it out themselves, and very seldom. It has happened occasionally, but only later on in things, usually when they'll combined. When they got to Morris combined, all the other situations, things like that, all got combinations going on at the same time.
Yeah, but they're only the exceptions.
So. Yeah, they're the exceptions. On the whole, Cambridge tend to sit on things, thrash them out themselves, and then come out with a bang. Good luck to them.
I suppose one could also say this is true because there was no great antagonism between Jodrell and Sydney.
No. There was a common denominator. One was Taffy Bowen, for example, was an X-radar type. An old colleague of Henry Brown's.
Well, that's true of all the groups.
It's true of everyone, isn't it? Yeah.
They knew each other during the war and so forth. So what was the next thing you worked on?
Gosh, I forgot the thing. After them. Oh, right. I was interested in interferometry in particular, the technique side. And in some ways, I think this is, just a side comment at the moment, fairly interesting that I remember hearing Martin Ryle a long time ago saying that he was really a radio engineer or something.
Yes.
Well, it was very often drawn on by the challenge of the techniques. I mean, at certain points, you had the challenge of the actual astronomy. But very often, it was the technique side that was fascinating.
Yes, I've heard other people tell me this.
Yes, it's rather curious, and it still is so in the sort of fields I'm working at the moment, that I find it most rewarding to think up new things. But this time, in the early 50s, one had the history of Michelson before you, and everything he'd done, and wonderful informative sound. And now you had a new medium, you had radio, and Andrew thought out the principle, used first, the intensity interferometers. Martin Ryle had come out with the phase switch interferometer, and I'm talking about the mid-50s by now.
Right.
And what else was there? I'd come up with the three-station interferometer as part of it. No, I think that one was really of necessity, because I had to measure Cygnus. Somehow or other, so people like Bracewell would not argue with me. I had to think of some way of doing it, so that's the way that came about, really. I think it was a necessity more than anything. But it gave one the challenge. What else could you do with interferometers that Michelson hadn't done? For example, he had done the three-station interferometer.
Right.
And I actually made an optical burst on that in the late 50s, I suppose, sometimes just for fun. Anyway, someone thought of other types. And what I thought of, I still get queries about, because, curiously enough, the theoreticians have never liked the results that I claim to have got with it, and I never bothered to do anything more about it. I just tell them I got confidence in what I did was right. It's up to them to try it again. But don't just stick to your theory. If you don't believe me, try it.
Yeah.
And this was an interferometer, which I call the harmonic interferometer.
I see.
It was an X-string you could do. And what I did there was to take the signals coming in through one antenna system and to put them through the first stages as usual, to amplify them up a bit, making sure that those first stages are rather linear, by the way, in this case. Now, I miss out a lot of the technique, the wrong mixes and coherence things here and there, but in principle, the signal goes into one antenna, it amplifies somewhat, goes into a squirrel or device, and you take out the second harmonic.
Yeah.
Now, you can actually convert down to IF, signal harmonically IF, it doesn't matter, this is linear.
Right.
Systems, so it doesn't matter. But I take out the harmonic of that signal, second harmonic. Then I have a second antenna, which is tuned to the second harmonic, and picks up signals from the sky at the second harmonic. You bring those two signals together and correlate. You're taking the artificially formed second harmonic of one signal and beating it against the celestially received second harmonic on the other side. And I tried it. I got wonderful results from, for example, ignition interference from any CW oscillator I could tune in, because the sensitivity of a system like that to tiny percentages of harmonics is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It really goes to town, as you well imagine. And I looked at Cassiopeia and I looked at Cygnus. There was nothing happening on Cassiopeia and Cygnus that registered at all. In other words, fairly white noise did nothing to it, as you can check with the noise diode, of course. You didn't get any correlation, but anything like a delta function did. Delta function means that all the signals are starting at the same instant of time,
right.
Therefore the harmonics are in phase at that instant, and they come out with a bang. So, pressing a switch or anything like that. Now look at the sun. And on the sun, the quiet sun did nothing, and most things that were happening on the sun did nothing. But over the period I used it, it was about 6 months, and I was doing it at the same time
when
as
when was
the,
this now?
It was during the time that Latham was there, towards the end of the time that Latham was there, I suppose.
So it'd be towards the end of the base interferometer work. 56, thereabouts, roughly. On the sun, there were, for the 6 months or so, there were four events which produced wonderful harmonic correlation. That is, I had on display, on a three-pen recorder,
right.
I had the output from channel A, fundamental, output from channel B, the second harmonic, and output from channel C, the cross product between these two. And so often you get something appearing on the first two, but wasn't correlating. So, four events, though, did appear, correlate on the second, on the third pen.
Right.
And these ones did not show a straightforward correlation, that is, they didn't show a single uniphase bump. The phase rotated, in other words, it fringed.
I see.
As though the second harmonic wasn't quite a second harmonic, it was slightly out of tune.
Yeah.
Okay, by the odd cycle per minute or second, whatever it was, I can't remember how fast it was running. Not quite in tune. And so all I did with that was just write it up very briefly in the observatory, saying that I made this type of interferometer, I tried on various things, didn't show anything except on the sun, and I quoted these events and quoted also all events which appeared in the quarterly bulletin of solar activity. So they were actually solar events, it wasn't my own imagination. I checked them on our own solar records as well, of course, but they were in the quarterly bulletin from the Netherlands as real solar events. And those four had produced this correlation, but many looking like it didn't. And one can argue that if you have a type 2 type event, or even a weak type 2 type event, it can be a full type 2, then the where there's a second harmonic production, the second harmonic, of course, is in a different refractive index.
Right.
It's being produced in a different refractive index to the fundamental, and it's moving through it, so the Doppler shifts are not the same from birth. Okay? So the second harmonic will not be quite a second harmonic, not
very
quite coherent to second harmonic. Yeah. And there have been the odd queries about that recently, but every time that anybody queries about it, say, but we gather that the theoreticians don't believe you. And it's always amusing me. I thought, well, one day maybe they'll try it.
Nobody's actually tried it. Yes, nobody's actually followed it up experimentally.
As far as I know, nobody's ever followed it up.
Huh.
It's extraordinary. And anyway, that was one of the little things I did then. Then I moved to, there are many other things. I moved to the hydrogen line work, extragalactic hydrogen line
Well,
work.
This is
very,
the...
Oh.
This is the big dish came along.
Okay, sorry, my family.
This is when the, about when
that's
the big dish
right.
came along.
I didn't like this rule, but there was a bit of confusion. What had happened was that, I was really an interferometer man by then. Independently, or under Hanbury, Henry Palmer had been working on another interferometer system, straightforward sort of interferometer system. And Lovell had more or less promised me that when the big dish came along, I could do interferometer with a big dish. I think Henry must have heard about this and didn't like it, so he must have prevailed upon Lovell, I think. Because Lovell then tried to get me to take over the hydrogen line work.
I see.
And I didn't really want to do it. I was much too much a lover of interferometry. But I did, anyway. I took over the work on that, and the main thing was then to... Lillian McLean had come out around about then with a paper claiming that Cygnus showed extragalactic absorption.
Right.
So the big thing was to see whether Lily and McLean were right or not.
Did you?
Something I hated doing. I hated, literally hated that work. It took a lot of doing because...
Did you think they were right? Or did the data look good?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think I was open-minded. Can't remember. Just can't remember. But I didn't like doing it. I don't like... Perhaps I think we must have suspected they were wrong. I think we probably suspected. But I never like having to show that somebody else is wrong. It doesn't appeal. And also, if you do it from one's own point of view, it means that you've got to go a hell of a lot further than the other chap who first published. You've got to go not just one order of magnitude very often, you've got to go two orders of magnitude, which we did. We actually went about a couple of orders of magnitude beyond Lily McLean and showed that up to that point, on Cygnus at least, there apparently was no... we would not claim, anyway, that there was any extragalactic absorption. We did see something... Actually, on Cygnus, on Virgo, very slightly. I remember arguing with Ron Davis about it. I think we published it because Ron Davis claimed it wasn't significant. It rather amused me in later years that somebody, I think, did find a little bit of absorption in front of Virgo. But we did Virgo at the same time as Cygnus. It was tricky. The dish wasn't ideal for it with a lot of apex reflection. We were going much bigger scans than anybody had been before. And technique-wise, it was very tiring. Business.
Yeah, it just did not fascinate you, apparently.
Pardon?
It just did not fascinate you.
I don't like that epoch in my life, really. Yeah. I didn't really enjoy it. And I wanted to get out of it, which I ultimately did.
When did you leave Jarrow?
Well, in the late 50s, I asked Lavin if there was anything else going. I wanted to get out of the housing line, and he mentioned that Britain was getting seriously interested in space research, would I be interested in doing something there, and that in the field of meteors and radio astronomy up there, we might be able to do something. So he left it entirely to me, of course, and at that point, the Americans and the Russians had got very peculiar results in the flux of dust particles, micrometeorite particles from space vehicles, which seemed to be much higher than one was expecting. So nearly all the debris coming onto the Earth, mm-hmm. millions of tons of stuff, seemed to be in that part of the spectrum of particles. They were using microphones, both the Russians and the Americans. I thought of a new technique, very simple. This is not radio astronomy, so I won't go into it, but it was entirely different. Using perforation of aluminium foil.
Why was it that you wanted to change from radio astronomy?
I didn't necessarily want to change from radio astronomy, I just didn't want to be working in a hydrogen lab. There was nothing else going.
And so in order for you to stay at Jarrow, that was essentially...
Really mind, and I suppose if I was staying at Jarrow a lot, I just got fed up with the hydrogen lab work. So I did this, and incidentally that apparatus was flown in Aerial 2, and it brought down the flux of those particles from previous values by a factor of well over 1,000.
I see.
And now it's accepted sort of level.
When was this, Aerial 2?
63, something around that.
Now I see that you have a paper in 1960 on the possibility of doing radio astronomy from artificial satellites.
Yes, that created a bit of a sensation because I spotted you could get two things. First of all, I looked upon it as there were lots of papers, you could call them papers, then some technical journals, some new scientists, or something like that, and possibly something. It went in stages. The first thing I realised was that the ionosphere ought to act as a sort of Lloyd's mirror, pretty crudely, if you were sitting on top of it, and therefore, interferometry-wise, it looked rather interesting. One might be able to make use of that to study the angular diameters and so on. That was the very first thing I published, that at least from the top, the ionosphere would reflect, and you get another thing out. Later on, we got onto it that it wasn't just reflecting, it was refracting, and it would focus radiation, and that, I think it's the order of a megacycle or so, you could actually get the beamwidth from an aerial hundreds of kilometres across just from a Hertzian dipole.
From a satellite?
Yes.
Looking through the ionosphere at a cosmic source?
You sit your satellite just above the critical level of the ionosphere, and or tune your receiver to just above the critical frequency.
Right.
Okay? When you're on the top side, right? Now, if you now trace out the ray paths, you'll find that they go out almost parallel upwards, because the ones that are directed straight up obviously go straight up. The ones that go out sideways are bent round come up almost straight up. And the ones that are directed downwards go down a little bit and then up again focusing. So you get the equivalent of an enormous dish formed by the ionosphere, provided you tune at that frequency.
Has this principle been used, or the ionosphere?
We tried it on the Black Knight rocket in the early 60s, and then Graham Smith went to town more on it and wrote quite a lot about it.
So it has been used, this principle.
He tried it, I don't know how he got on with it. Because
I don't think in the Radio Astronomy Explorer satellites they use anything like this, do they?
Probably not. Just straight
observations with a long antenna.
Yes. Yeah. The other thing I went on to from it was using occultation of the Earth. I didn't actually fly these satellites, but I proposed techniques for using occultation of the Earth with its ionosphere to give you a sort of refractive occultator.
I see.
And to look at the... to look at the sky, if you like, for anything that might be around in those frequencies, mm-hmm. that way on. Never did the experiment.
Right.
I got involved a bit, as you see there, in that, but at that time I'd also got involved in an experiment to measure the speed of gravity, which led me to something that's occupied me almost ever since. As a result of a conversation with Bondi, who said we didn't know how a ray of light crossed a rotating system. I was so shattered, more shattered than I'd ever been in all my life. And I solved that one and went on to other problems in rotation which people take for granted but which are not understood and not known. And that's led me on from that to inertia and similar things. And so my own real interest these days is strongly in accelerated systems, if you like, and making sense of them. which, yeah, curiously enough, although we all think it's been done, it hasn't been done.
Yes. David Edge was telling me about some of these experiments that you've done and such. There's another meeting that I forgot to mention. That was the 58 Symposium in Paris.
Yes.
What are your impressions? You were at that meeting?
I was at that meeting. I remember David Edge quoting something I said at that meeting. I probably was. I know it was right, but I can't remember what it was.
He does have something in his book, I
said. I can't remember. Yeah. There's some comment over there. The other thing I remember was Bracewell claiming that Cygnus was all wrong, and there were three bumps at least, and this bridge in the middle, and rather amusing. Sorry, it's just that so often, I mean, I meet this a lot these days in relativity, even more so, sometimes when a chap is crowned with erudition. How extraordinarily blind they can be to common sense. It's a ridiculous business. Maybe if you stick too much in the theory or something.
Yeah. You common sense the same to an experimentalist.
Well, I don't know what it is.
Don't think that way.
Yes, it's a different method of thought. Yeah. As within the... again, one meets this very much. One hears so often that thought experiments are no good. They'll never teach you anything, a thought experiment. You'll see this written up time and time again. By the philosophers of science, this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
Because you only put in what you start with. It's a lot of absolute nonsense. Agree you only put in what you start with. But there's nothing like a thought experiment for clearing the air, for making sense of things. In fact, the average experimentalist uses a thought experiment nearly all the time. Sure. He thinks up this, he thinks up that, he discards it because of this, he discards it because of that. In the end, he gets a beautiful, clear conception of the way he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And it's all done by thought experiments.
Yeah, that's right.
Without spending a penny. And it's a terribly important way of doing it. And you can apply the same principles in theoretical work and do it beautifully. And it works marvellously. The trouble is that some people do it wrongly. And that's why it's got a bad name. But Einstein's original 1905 paper was a thought experiment.
Yeah.
The exploding light complex was a pure thought experiment. Yeah. So, and so it goes on. There are beautiful things, thought experiments. And I'm all for reinstating them as a very, very valuable part of... science. Sorry, I'm flattering.
No, this is very interesting comments. You have given me a very thorough going through of what you worked on in the 1950s. I might ask a more general question. As you look at the development of radio astronomy up until 1960 or so, do you have any comments that you would like to weigh?
Got one comment. Can I give you exactly the same comment that I gave to David Edge or David Edge's minion? When they were doing their survey, and which appeared in a write-up that I saw of this chapter as the very enigmatic reply. I was the responsible for the very enigmatic reply to the question, what, in your opinion, were the three greatest discoveries in radio astronomy?
Yeah.
And my so-called very enigmatic reply was Hayes' first three discoveries.
Right.
Right?
Why is that enigmatic?
I don't know.
It's a straight answer.
No. It seems to me to be a straight answer. The meteor astronomy scope, the solar radio astronomy, and Cygnus.
Right.
Right? And look what's come from those.
Right.
I'd still stick to it.
Each one's founded a whole branch.
That's right.
If you throw in Jansky for galactic background.
Yes, you've got to take Jansky as dark in it, I agree. But if you then take within that spectrum of radio astronomy that was done, three greatest things, I think, were Hayes, three things at the end of the war, general and the end of the war. And I'd stick to it.
I guess I might throw in Van der Holt's discovery along with the actual discovery, and then and those five things sort of encompasses all of the radio astronomy.
Yes, it's all right. So I don't know why David Edge referred to it as the enigmatic reply. Everybody else seemed to come out with something relatively modern. Is that the other one? Well, I stick to those. That founded the science.
Right.
Really.
Well, thank you very
much.
So that ends the interview with Jennison on 31 August 76.